Think about the last time you had to cancel a subscription. There's probably some waiting on hold, some guessing at your password, some mind-numbing small talk, and maybe after all that, you still weren't able to cancel it. Good news, it doesn't have to be this way. Thanks to Rocket Money. Rocket Money tracks, manages, and can cancel your subscriptions for you. When you connect your accounts, you'll see a complete picture of all your recurring subscriptions all in one place. Rocket Money organizes your subscriptions by due date and notifies you when something's coming up, so you'll never be caught off guard when you get charged. If you see a subscription you want to cancel, Rocket Money simplifies the process. Instead of waiting on hold for an hour, you can cancel it right from the app. Rocket Money will even try to get you a refund for the money you spent on subscriptions you forgot about. Stop wasting your time trying to cancel subscriptions the hard way. Make your life easier and go to rocketmoney.com/cancel. That's rocketmoney.com/cancel. Or download the app from the Apple app or Google Play stores.
Moto Casino, America's social casino.
Welcome to Moto Casino, where the excitement never ends. With thousands of the hottest free-to-play social casino games, fastest payouts, and the best promotions in the industry. No tricks or gimmicks. Owned and operated in the USA.
Moto Casino is a free-to-play social casino. No purchase necessary. 21 plus to play. Void where prohibited.
Sign up today for a generous welcome bonus.
Moto Casino.
Download the Moto Casino app today.
So they sail quite far south, but they don't find anything, which eventually leads Cook to change course and decide to go westward towards New Zealand, or which, again, they already knew about. They already knew of its existence because it had been discovered by Abel Tasman in the early 1600s. But Cook, when he arrived there, was the first European navigator to basically circumnavigate the entire, well, both islands. And again, putting his cartography skills on full display, drew the most pristine, detailed map of the islands and its boundaries.
Yeah. And I think, isn't it, for generations it wasn't bettered?
Oh, yeah.
For like, yeah, well, 100 years or
yeah
more.
Yeah, 150 years, something like that, yeah. But obviously, I'd be remiss not to mention something of the encounter with the Maoris.
Right.
Whilst he's there. So I think it's important to mention that the Tahitians, the Maoris, the Easter Islanders, they're all a part of the same sort of ethnic group. They all speak a similar language. When they came from Tahiti, they actually took one of the natives on board with them called Tupia.
Right.
Because Banks had become quite friendly with him and he thought it would be useful to have a translator for any of the islands they went on. And when they got to New Zealand, it turned out that Tupia and the Maori could perfectly speak to one another. They both spoke the Polynesian language because obviously that's where they come from. The New Zealanders had arrived, the Maoris had arrived in New Zealand in about 1300, something like that, from the Polynesian islands. Mm. But the Maori were in many ways like the Tahitians in the rampant thievery, or sometimes even worse. They'd be trading and the Europeans would pass them something and then they'd just bolt and not give hand over the thing that they'd obviously said they were going to trade in.
People say, sorry, just a quick second, to say, oh, that's just their culture, was it? Oh, they're just thieves.
Mm.
Yeah, oh, they didn't understand property rights. So, is it that? Or are they just cheeky bastards? They're just thieves.
Right.
I think they largely did understand about the idea of ownership.
You would get the general idea, right?
Right,
you would get the idea of what the Europeans expected out of you eventually. But this was in the time that Cook sailed around these two islands, there was a constant pattern of some would be very, very friendly and some would attack with spears. So there was one occasion where they fired muskets purposefully over their heads in order to sort of make them surrender, and they didn't, and the Maori in there came up in their canoe and just started lobbing spears and anything they had in the boat at them. And this resulted in the Marines firing down into the Maori's boat and killing a lot of them. But as soon as three of the younger ones were taken aboard, they were just, it was like nothing had ever happened. All of a sudden the younger ones were, oh, what's that? And what's that? And, oh, can I have this? And everything, like nothing had happened. There's just a real, it's fascinating, like the behaviour of them.
It's funny, there's so many parallels with Drake's voyages, exactly the same thing. You'd never know. Sometimes they were extremely friendly. Mm. They couldn't have been more welcoming and friendly. And other times they greet you with spears. Mm. One time, some native peoples just rode their canoe out to the Golden Hind,
right,
to attack it. And Drake's like, "It's a little canoe."
Yeah.
And he's like, "Okay, really? We'll fire one shot, one cannon across their bow." Okay. So yeah, you just never knew.
No.
You just never knew if they were going to be nice or not. Yeah. But
really unpredictable. But it's that thing as well that, you know, eventually as they're circumnavigating New Zealand, word would spread amongst the different tribes that, oh, you know, there's this big ship sailing around and it's handing out all this stuff. And, you know, so before you knew it, like sort of a lot of the islanders knew what was, you know, on the north and then the south, what was going on. And as he went, they'd stick up the good old Union flag, you know, and say, "God save King George," and they claim the island in the for Great Britain, as they did. And there's a, you know, obviously still part of the Commonwealth today, and that's really where the story of our relationship with New Zealand began, back with Cook's voyage.
I suppose one last thing to mention, it is interesting that the Maori were sort of Polynesian islanders that came to New Zealand, rather than being sort of autochthonous, sort of being from New Zealand from time immemorial, or not from Australia.
Yes.
They're not Australian Aboriginals.
No.
Australian Aboriginals and Maoris are different things.
Totally, yeah.
Right? It is interesting to sort of note that. Mm. And that the Maori haven't been on New Zealand for, you know, like 40,000 years or anything.
Yeah.
It's not like that.
No.
It's interesting just to note that. But carry on.
Well, eventually, obviously, they parted from New Zealand and sailed over to New Holland, or Australia, as we now know it. And there seems to be one of those sort of rookie, normie misconceptions that Cook discovered Australia, which isn't true, as I said, the Dutch did. But he was the first European to set foot on the eastern side of Australia, which obviously has most of its famous cities, you know, Sydney and all that, which is where they first land, in Botany Bay.
Right, that's the famous thing, isn't it?
Yeah, which obviously there's many famous paintings and pictures of, and it's a very iconic image in many ways. But as regards to their first contact with the Aborigines, and as you say, they're totally different people, their own language, their own culture, in total contradiction to the way that the Polynesians had greeted the Europeans, the Aborigines were just very, didn't really think anything of it. They didn't come out in longboats like the Polynesians had and just sort of circle the ship wanting to trade. They kept back, they kept to themselves. Every now and then the men would just sort of see fires in the distance, either warning that something was happening or, you know, just sending signals to one another. But no one would. Every now and then, of course, they'd see them in the distance. Like, they'd see, you know, dark men with big spears, you know, in the distance. But they wouldn't. Yeah, it wasn't. It was a very cold, sort of aloof introduction.
Mm.
There was not. It was very different to what they'd had thus far on the voyage.
It's interesting to say the Australian Aboriginals have been on the Australian landmass for thousands and thousands and
tens
thousands.
Tens of thousands.
Right, yeah. It's actually quite odd. Some of the cave paintings, some of the archaeology is odd how long they've been there.
Yeah.
It's like that's some of the oldest stuff. That's going back to some of the oldest stuff we've got in Africa.
Yeah.
Wait, how can that be? Anyway, we won't get into that today. But they're sort of very different. They weren't particularly, we say, standoffish. They weren't warlike.
No.
They're not sort of like coming out to try and kill them or anything remotely like that. I suppose you mentioned New Holland because, of course, well, you've got the Spanish and the Portuguese, but then the Dutch. I mean, there's the Dutch East Indies.
Yeah.
It's not called that anymore, is it? But so the Dutch largely came from the other way.
Yeah, from the western.
Coming from the western side.
Yeah.
And so, sort of the battle between the sort of low burn, very low burn, very low key, very low numbers of spanning centuries of a battle between the Spanish, the Portuguese, the Dutch and the British.
Yes.
Over dominance, over that whole massive part of the globe.
Hmm.
Obviously, Cook playing an important and still fairly early role in it all.
Mm, absolutely. So they sail, keep sort of sailing up the eastern coastline of Australia until eventually a major disaster happens, but it turns out to basically be Cook's finest hour as a seaman, as a voyager and as a captain, really, because basically the ship hits upon hard rock and coral upon the Great Barrier Reef. Now, obviously, the Great Barrier Reef is enormous. It's about, I think it's like the top half of the east side of Australia. It's a huge, and this entire labyrinth of coral, obviously, they didn't know it was there, and they have to navigate all of this. But they hit it, and the Endeavour starts to leak badly. And at that point, it's all hands on deck, and even the gentlemen, who obviously would normally, they're there to give orders. They don't do any actual manual labour. Mm-hmm. But no, all the jackets were off, all the sleeves were up, and everyone was involved in pumping the water out of the ship or throwing things overboard to get rid of weight until the tide. Well, they were already at high tide, I think, when it happened. So it was basically as shallow gets, and they managed to get enough water beneath the ship, and Cook had them get out the rowboats and literally row the ship away from the rock and towards land. But it was an enormously tense, this was over the space of about 24 hours, and when you're there in the middle of nowhere with one ship, no backup, in uncharted territory, no one's coming to save you. If your ship goes down, you're there for basically life, probably.
You might be marooned forever.
If not just drowned, right? If you don't just die there and then. But Cook conducted it in such an orderly and calm, disciplined manner. And he basically said that it was the finest, crew he'd ever had in that moment. He couldn't have been more proud of them. So, yeah, it was really something. But that meant that they had to obviously go ashore in Australia and spend weeks repairing the ship.
Yeah, no, it's touch and go in that moment. Yeah. And these moments sort of make a man, don't they? How you react under pressure. And again, Cook was able to pass with aplomb.
Yes. Absolutely. I thought I'd read from my second extract now, because I thought this is Cook's direct thoughts on the Aborigines. And I just thought it was quite an interesting view for him to take when I find it in my makeshift bookmarks. So he says, "From what I have said of the natives of New Holland, they may appear to some to be the most wretched people upon earth, but in reality, they are far more happier than we Europeans, being wholly unacquainted, not only in the superfluous, but the necessary conveniences so much sought after in Europe. They are happy in not knowing the use of them. They live in a tranquillity which is not disturbed by the inequality of condition. The earth and sea of their own accord furnishes them with all the necessaries of life. They covet no magnificent houses, household stuff and others. They live in a warm and fine climate and enjoy a very wholesome air, so that they have very little need of clothing, and this they seem to be fully sensible of, for many of whom we give cloth to, they left it carelessly upon the sea beach, and in the woods as a thing they have had no manner of use for. In short, they seem to set no value upon anything we gave them, nor would they ever part with anything of their own for any one article we could offer them. This, in my opinion, argues that they think themselves provided with all the necessaries of life, and that they have no superfluities." So I just found that a remarkable one. There's a hint of Rousseau's Noble Savage in it, I think, as well, though, which I found an interesting point of view from Cook's perspective.
There's some great accounts from Alfred Wallace, who went into in the Amazon basin and found basically Aboriginal type people, basically people living in quite literally the Stone Age.
Yes.
And he thought how wonderful it was, how happy they were to see their kids sort of frolicking in absolute natural freedom and things. I personally don't buy any of that.
No.
They're backward. I call them backward. They've failed to progress.
I find it remarkable, though, that there's something within that that there is no genuine desire to progress, which yeah, I see as just such a fundamental part of human nature. Not in, like, the progressive, you know, political sense, but just to advance things, to push, to discover, yeah.
To have an imagination.
Yeah.
To have a high enough IQ that you can imagine what might be better in the future and work towards it. I don't think it's great. I don't think it's something... This is just me getting on my high horse slightly. I don't think it's wonderful and beautiful that the Aborigines had as much time, essentially, as we did and built nothing. And then when you show them machine tools and things, precision engineered items, they still don't even care. They don't even realise that it's something of value. Mm. That's not good. That's terrible, actually. Yeah. But anyway, well. probably get some comments about that, saying that I'm xenophobic or whatever, but I don't care.
Should be fun.
Yeah.
So they sail, eventually they get the ship repaired just to go far enough to Indonesia. And they arrive in Batavia, or modern-day Jakarta, which at that point was obviously a colony of the Dutch. Mm. Mm. And obviously now that they've finally arrived at another European port, Cook can pass on his notes to be sent away to the Admiralty for his research. And one of the things that he proudly notes in it is we've not lost a single man to scurvy.
Right.
Because he'd been feeding them, he'd been forcing them because, yeah, it's that thing. You can be very, well, I don't like that. I like this. Or this is what I've always had before this on the ship. Why are you making me eat this now? That's not, you know, people get picky and fussy, just like they do today. Mm. But Cook was like, well, fine, the officers will eat it. And you'll see that we're eating it and you'll eat it too. But I'm not having anyone dying of scurvy on this ship. Mm. So he proudly notes that. But the problem is that Batavia is a horrendous, rancid, malaria-ridden place. Mm-hmm. And in the time there, whilst they have no choice, they have no choice because the ship needs to be repaired after the incident on the Great Barrier Reef. But that means just sitting it out in this disease-ridden cesspit for weeks and weeks, which ends up losing Cook about 30 of his crew. Just gone, including many of... including the artist Sidney Parkinson, who it might be possible to get some of his work up on the actual display on the Epoch, but we still have some of his stuff, his drawings of the Maori and of some of the plants that he saw on the voyage and some of it. But yeah, just taken in the prime of his life by just having to wait in this malaria-ridden dung heap.
Yeah, it's interesting. Quite often we get told that when the Europeans visited these new places, we brought diseases with them as though it was like deliberate, as though it was like a type of biological warfare. Of course it wasn't. What very rarely gets told is the other way round. Yeah, the East and the Americas had diseases that we got and that killed us in droves.
Yes.
For example, just cholera. Mm. Like, why was there cholera in 18th and 19th century London? Because we brought it back from India. Thanks for that, India. And it killed loads of us. Yeah, people from Europe would go to the Spice Islands, the Dutch East Indies, the East Indies, whatever it is, and yeah, and die in droves because we weren't used to the diseases that were out there.
Yeah.
And the natives had some protection against. Mm. So it went both ways.
Yeah, for sure.
100%.
Yeah. Anyway. Eventually they got the ship working again, but they were working with basically a skeleton crew because most of the crew was either dead or incapacitated from the illness, but eventually they managed to get themselves towards Cape Town in South Africa.
Right.
Which I won't go into it in deep detail, but at the time it was interesting. They noted just how beautiful it was, that the Cape Town itself was almost some great paradise that the Europeans had created down there, that it was both magnificent in landscape, but also just, yeah, civilizationally, it was apparently a really wonderful place to be. And then they hopped over to St. Helena quickly to restock, and then it was back home to Britain, and thus ends the first voyage.
Right. Yeah, that's another thing. Even in the early 20th century, it was like the Cape was, Cape Town in South Africa was a nice place to go, a nice port of call, a welcome, a nice port of call. not so much anymore.
Yeah, shame.
Yeah. So that last ends the first of the three big expeditions, right?
Absolutely, yeah. Which obviously was a buzz back in the back in Britain, you know, that what had been achieved. But what's important to note is that sort of in the social high social circles, Cook got very little recognition for it because Banks had been around, done the circuit, met the king and all that, and had really just sold the whole idea to them that it was his expedition. He'd still never really let that go.
Right.
And so, but it was one of those things. Cook had his journal, as I obviously have, and, you know, he documented it all, and as far as the Admiralty were concerned, they were very impressed with his conduct throughout the whole journey, and it was quickly established that there would be a second voyage.
Right.
And Banks, once again, would go on this great second voyage of his own, and Cook would, of course, be there with him. And it's remarkable, really, because Banks and Cook, despite all that time together, would never go on a voyage ever again, because Banks had really let his ego get to him by this point and said, and they'd got two Whitby Cats built up. They would become the HM Resolution and the Adventure.
To watch the full video, please become a premium member at lotuseaters.com.
Moro Casino, America's social casino.
Welcome to Moto Casino, where the excitement never ends, with thousands of the hottest free-to-play social casino games, fastest payouts, and the best promotions in the industry. No tricks or gimmicks. Owned and operated in the USA.
Moto Casino is a free-to-play social casino. No purchase necessary. 21 plus to play. Void where prohibited.
Sign up today for a generous welcome bonus.
Moto Casino, America's social casino.
Download the Moto Casino app today.